Thank you very much. Is this thing working by any chance?
Of course not.
Turn up the volume, the man says. What do you expect? Something, some simple technological solution? There we go.
That's Bob Victor, who does the very, very funny Sky Calendar, which I recommended, I think it was 2 lectures ago. It's hard to keep track of all the snow cancellations and so forth. And he is from Abrams Planetarium, but of course it is Abrams that is sponsoring this series. For all those announcements that Bob added, gave you, I'll add a couple more.
First of all, those of you who are around other parts of the state of Michigan might be interested in this mimeographs handout, which we prepared at the planetarium in Ann Arbor, and which lists all of the things that happen having to do with public astronomy on the U of N campus in Ann Arbor, whether I'm doing them or not, and all of the things that I'm doing, whether they're in Ann Arbor or not. So there's a series here, a series there, and so on. You are most welcome to these, and I will put them out here on the stage. And if you wish one, or if you have friends in some of these distant exotic localities, feel free to take several, or if you have friends who'd be interested in this. Be warned about one thing, though, that everything on the sheet is still correct, except the schedule for this Michigan State series. And the reason for that is because of the snowstorms that, as Bob mentioned, have caused two of the programs to be postponed so far. So if you want the schedule for the Michigan State series, ignore what is on there and pick up one of the yellow slips, which look like this and which are in various locations at the back of the room. Other announcements. WKAR-FM, which has been taping the last few lectures, you notice is not there tonight, and that's good, not bad, because what we're probably going to do, this is still a little uncertain as to whether they can pull it off financially, but what we're probably going to do is have a condensed version of each of the lectures as a special program for them. These lectures are a little bit unwieldy for them to broadcast, and it makes it a bit difficult for them also because they have slides, and of course the radio people have trouble seeing the slides. KAR is quite a colorful station, but that's asking a little too much. The next broadcast of one of the lectures will be the Venus lecture, which I gave in January. That was the one the weather permitted me to give in January. And that one will be broadcast on two successive days. It turned out that particular lecture divided itself really very nicely into two sub-lectures, and so it doesn't hurt to cut it in half this time. Two successive days at 10 a.m. on WKAR-FM, which is 90.5 megahertz. And that is their regular lecture slot. The dates will be Thursday, March 23rd, and Friday, March 24th. First half of the lecture, which is primarily about the Venus atmosphere, will be on the 23rd. Second half, primarily about Venus geology and the interior of the planet, will be on the 24th. Now, the next announcement, there's no point in my giving you, if you can't hear the station, can you receive the rock station from Detroit, WABX, here? Does anybody? Okay, I see a sea of blank faces. So on occasion, is that it? Well, okay, it's definitely an occasion. It's 7:15 in the morning this coming Sunday, so it's going to be only for the most dedicated among you at that. Well, I'm going to be talking an interview with a lady they've got named Trudy Milliner on a program called Radio Free Detroit. I love that title, which is broadcast at 7:15 on Sunday morning. It'll be this coming Sunday. The station is 99 FM, and it will be for 1 hour on space colonization. Oh, and another announcement, too, about space colonization. For those of you who are interested in that subject, and we've been mentioning it periodically through this series, and we did have a lecture on it back in May with myself and Tom Heppenheimer, we've talked about the L5 Society a number of times, and that's a citizens group which is interested in the concept and which you can join, and of which there is a chapter here at Michigan State, which I'll be happy to plug if there's anybody here from L5. I don't notice the two or three that I know. Apparently there was some false information floating around. At least one of them is expecting to come next Thursday, and is going to be very unhappy when she discovers that it was a week ago. There is an L5 Society here on campus, but in addition, Gerard O'Neill, who was the originator of the concept in its modern form, has started a nonprofit institute for space studies. It's called the Institute for Space Studies. to do some of the badly needed footwork that still has to be done and still can be done on a relatively modest scale in this relatively early stage of the program. Obviously, the time will come when private institutes funded by public donations aren't enough. But if you would like to become a member of that, they put out a newsletter, so does the L5 Society. This will give you another look at it. And it's $10 a year. And the address, fascinating, the address I don't have here. All right. The address is Space Science Institute, care of Professor Gerard O'Neill, Princeton University, Physics Department, Princeton, New Jersey. You know, that'll get to them. Whatever the correct address is, they'll forward it. Okay, what we've got here tonight is a lecture about Jupiter, and that is the primary goodie. But we have something else for you especially, which was not advertised. It just happened I was able to get it at the last minute, and it only lasts 4 minutes, and I thought you'd like to see it. It's a really superb film clip, which was put out originally for television use by the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston. And it is a clip of the first free flight of the approach and landing test of the Space Shuttle Orbiter. And without further ado, I'd like to put that on now. We have a slide on again. Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank Eva Payne of NASA Johnson Space Center for supplying that to us on very short notice. A few more announcements that I thought of while we were watching that. There are always a lot of them. Tomorrow night in Ann Arbor, I am giving the first of a series of three presentations, mostly a lecture, but also some films, on updates of the Viking Mars findings, things that have been learned in the last year or so, and that is material that I guarantee you aren't going to get anywhere else. Even the specialized news media have started in on that. The other two are next Friday and the Friday after, and all the information about those is here on this mimeograph sheet, including detailed driving directions on how to get there. The Voyager recording, as you heard on the way in, is being played. We played the first of the four segments, four half-hour segments roughly that we've chopped it up into today, and the remaining three, all of which are music, will be played before the beginning of each of the next three lectures. Those begin a little bit earlier than the segment that you heard today. Those begin at 7:05 p.m. And that information is on the yellow sheet, which gives the Michigan State schedule, and that's the one that is in the back of the room. The portion that you heard today is the entirety of the non-musical portion. We began, with a little bit of music, just a brief musical intro, which in fact is the same as the piece that ends the recording 2 hours later, and that is the Cavatina from Beethoven's 13th String Quartet. Then the greetings, first from Secretary General Waldheim, from a number of ordinary citizens in 55 separate languages, starting with ancient Sumerian, which is the oldest that is still known in enough detail that you could still say something in it, and ending with modern English. Then a series of greetings from members of the Outer Space Committee of the United Nations, and fading slowly into a couple of whales who sent their own greetings as well. And then that very remarkable sound essay, which was put together primarily by Andrew in New York City, starting with relatively simple sounds, volcanoes, mud pots, fire, thunderstorm, working up through natural sounds of a low order of complexity, insects and frogs and so forth, high order of complexity, finally simple human sounds, and then culminating in the one of the most complex of human sounds, the launch of a Saturn V. And then as a brief coda, perhaps the only section whose content was not more or less immediately obvious as to what was going on, there was little indication that life is still going on the Earth, is continuing, and is a part of the broader universe of which we are a part. A kiss, the cry of a baby, an electroencephalogram and an electrocardiogram as expresses audio analogs, and finally the very final sound, that hypnotic shh, 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 at the very end, that was a pulsar. So that's what that was about. The remainder of it is music, and in my opinion, one of the finest introductions you could possibly imagine to the musics of planet Earth. It was put together very carefully by ethnomusicologists and by other musical experts, and you can be sure that each of the pieces is a representative sample of its genre. It breaks down by time, 40% Western classical music, 10% American popular music, of which there are three different representations, And the remaining 50%, therefore, is music of types that you are not likely to have encountered before unless you are really into ethnomusicology. So I think it's a very interesting thing, quite aside from the fact that this is literally the most immortal music that the human race has ever produced. There is every reason to believe those recordings will last for billions of years into the future as the Voyager spacecraft carry them out among the stars. That's the end of the Voyager mission. The beginning of it is what I will start to talk about tonight and continue next time, which is called Beyond Jupiter, tonight's lecture being Jupiter. These are explorations of the outer solar system. We have already had two spacecraft out there, Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. The Voyagers are more complex, more sophisticated, they'll be able to do more. The idea is to send out a relatively simple, rugged, reliable spacecraft to brave the dangers of things like the asteroid belt and Jupiter's radiation belt, the former of which turned out to be much less dangerous than we thought it might be, the latter of which turned out to be a great deal more so. Once you have some notion of what the environment is like, then you can send in your more sophisticated, but therefore more fragile spacecraft, and that's what the Voyagers are about. Voyager is a spacecraft which was called Mariner Jupiter Saturn until just a few months before the launches, which were last year. And you're seeing the spacecraft there in artist conception, and we'll talk more about the project itself in the course of these two lectures. This is going to be, in some ways, the most exciting space mission yet. And I realize that it's possible to say that about a lot of them, define the word exciting in different ways, and therefore be correct with all of them. But it will be, and I'm afraid it's going to get less press attention than Viking did, although I'm sure a good deal more than Pioneer Venus, which I talked about last time, and was therefore especially anxious to introduce you to. But the reason that I think that it'll get less is, first of all, most reporters have never heard of Ganymede and Europa and Enceladus and Tethys and all the other worlds that these voyagers are going to be investigating. Secondly, they're not going to land anywhere. These are flyby missions, because that is what you do for the first reconnaissance of a brand new world. Some of them we know we couldn't land on. Jupiter, for example, doesn't even have a solid surface. The planet is entirely liquid and gaseous throughout. And others we do not know enough about their surfaces. For example, Titan, an exceedingly interesting world, but one that is so alien to our own, one that is so different from the sorts of things that we're used to exploring in the inner solar system that they make the Earth and the Moon and Mars and Venus look like twin brothers by comparison. For example, these bodies, for the most part, are not even made of rock, which in our inner solar system chauvinism we have come to think of as being what a planet is supposed to be made of. In fact, it turns out that's the exception, not the rule of the solar system, and I'll try to tell you why that is tonight. Voyager is going to fly past these worlds, and it is going, in so doing, to take photographs and other observations of them. We will get, from the two Voyagers, photographs of most of the surfaces of at least 15 separate worlds, by which I mean planets and moons, and don't neglect those moons. If nothing else tonight, I think I'll send you home with a realization that there are more major worlds in the solar system than just the 9 planets. Several of the moons in the outer solar system, 2 of Jupiter's, 1 of Saturn's, 1 of Neptune's, are bigger than the planet Mercury, and there are a number of others which are definitely full-scale major worlds in themselves. We will get pictures of most of the surfaces of at least 15 of these worlds in at least as great detail as we have in the best photographs of our own Earth's moon from the best telescopes on Earth. And most of these bodies are literally unknown at the present moment. They are simply dots of light in our best telescopes, which means we are going to be seeing, starting next year, when Voyager 1 and Voyager 2 later in the year arrive at Jupiter, the unbelievable spectacle of entire worlds, one after another, more than a dozen of them, suddenly becoming known in the space of a few hours. And it's just going to be an incredible thing to live through, a tremendously exciting time. I hope that the media gives some portion of the amount of coverage that this kind of thing really deserves. 15 worlds, that is twice as many as we have covered in all of space exploration to date, from just these two spacecraft. They were launched last year. Voyager 1 was launched second. Voyager 2 was launched first, in order to make sure you were as confused as possible. The reason for the nomenclature is that Voyager 1, although it was launched second, arrives first. And the reason for that is that Voyager 1 was the one that was launched second, was the fastest spacecraft that ever left the Earth. It traveled the distance from the Earth to the Moon in 8.5 hours. And Voyager 2, the one that was launched first, was only the second spacecraft ever to leave the Earth, second fastest spacecraft, and it was 56 miles an hour slower. That 56 miles an hour difference added up until on December 15th, they passed one another in the sense that they were both the same distance from the Sun. They were 3 million miles apart at the time from each other. And since then, Voyager 1 has landed. Voyager 1 will arrive at Jupiter next year, making its closest approach in March, although the telescopes from these on these spacecraft are so good that 2 months out from the planet, the Voyagers will be able to get pictures of Jupiter better than the best Earth-based photographs we can take through our biggest telescopes. And so for almost 4 months, we will have continuous observations of Jupiter, its weather, what is going on in its atmosphere from these spacecraft. Also, especially closer in, observations of the moons. And altogether, each spacecraft in each flyby will send back several hundred thousand pictures at the rate of about one every 45 seconds for a period of, well, not continuously, but through a large part of a period of 4 months at each flyby. Voyager 2 arrives later at Jupiter. It will have a somewhat different mission, different moons, different view of Jupiter. They then go on to Saturn. Voyager 1 arrives at Saturn in late 1980, and Voyager 2 in mid-1981, and we will get their observations of Saturn and at least 7 of its moons in the kind of detail that I was talking about. At Jupiter, we get Jupiter itself plus 5 of its moons. Oh yes, and at Saturn, of course, also we get Saturn's rings. There's a good chance that if all goes well, Voyager 2 will be sent on from Saturn to Uranus. And I am not counting Uranus and its 5 moons in that tally of at least 15 that I was giving you before. Uranus is an especially interesting planet. I won't talk about that tonight, but it will be a major part of the lecture Beyond Jupiter, which is next month's attraction, assuming that the snow allows it, on this peculiar planet that we inhabit. What's going on is that we live at a time that is very unusual in astronomical history, in that all 5 of the planets in the outer solar system, by planet I mean ones that go around the Sun, by world I mean either a moon or a planet, all 5 of the planets in the outer solar system are not lined up, something that I keep reading over and over again, it's simply not true, as a matter of fact it's physically impossible for them to be lined up, but they are in such a set of relative positions to one another, spread over almost 180 degrees of the solar system, but in such a set of relative positions that you could, if you wished, send a spacecraft to Jupiter and have it fly past Jupiter in exactly such a position and direction that Jupiter's gravity, which is very strong, Jupiter being the heaviest planet in the solar system, would speed it up and deflect its direction by exactly the right amount to send it on to Saturn. And Saturn would be at that point in Saturn's orbit when the spacecraft arrived, and would be capable of being passed at such a position and direction that Saturn's gravity would send the spacecraft onto Uranus. And Uranus, so help me, would be in the exact right position to do the same thing for Neptune, and Neptune would be in the right position to do it for Pluto. That sort of opportunity happens only once every 175 years. In other words, the last time that it happened, Thomas Jefferson was president of the United States. And the next time it happens will be the middle of the 22nd century. We had, in the early 1970s, a very ambitious plan to do exactly this, to send a spacecraft to all of those worlds. One of the wonderful things that President Nixon did for the country was to kill that project. And we will not have another chance to do it for 175 years. It was called Grand Tour, for obvious reasons. Voyager represents essentially an attempt to salvage as much as possible of the Grand Tour opportunity. These are Mariner-class spacecraft. It may not look like a Mariner, but it really is. And I'll say more about that later on, probably next week, actually. It is a Mariner-class spacecraft, and it is therefore more sophisticated than a Pioneer, less sophisticated than the full Grand Tour would have been. What we lose as a result of going Voyager instead of Grand Tour is Pluto and probably Neptune. There is a faint possibility that Voyager 2 may be sent from Uranus onto Neptune, but almost certainly not. And the reason is that it happens that if you fly past Uranus in the right direction to go to Neptune, you lose most of the interesting opportunities to observe Uranus itself. With Grand Tour, that wouldn't have mattered. There would have been two spacecraft, but here it does. There's only one by the time it gets there. Nevertheless, it is going to be a fantastic mission, and I hope, if nothing else tonight, to be able to, and next time, to be able to share some of the excitement of it with you. The bulk of the lecture tonight, however, is going to be to tell you what we already know about Jupiter and these incredible moons that revolve around it. And that is from Earth-based observations, and above all, from the two predecessor spacecraft, Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. The Pioneer series was, actually that name has undergone several changes in meaning. In the very earliest spacecraft, it was a set of U.S. Air Force lunar probes. U.S. Air Force, all the way back when NASA didn't even exist yet, and all of them were unsuccessful, as was common in the early days of the space program. In fact, we've forgotten now that the first 13 United States attempts to go to the moon failed one after another. The early pioneers were included among them. Then we had a series of very successful, for the most part, interplanetary probes, which didn't go to any planets, they studied interplanetary space, solar wind, cosmic rays, magnetic fields, that sort of thing. And actually, Pioneers 10 and 11, to a large extent, did that as well. But they were sent out to go past Jupiter, and in the case of Pioneer 11, Saturn as well. And they did make observations of those planets, including some very nice pictures. Those spacecraft will also leave the solar system. They are the first man-made object that will ever do so. They, too, have an identification of the human race on them, but they're a good deal smaller and simpler. They didn't have room for anything as complex as the Voyager recordings. Those are the famous plaques, which you have probably seen pictures of, and if not, you're going to tonight. So let me show you a magnificent Pioneer 10 picture of Jupiter itself, the king, and there it is. This picture was taken from 1.5 million miles away, and it is still 5 times as detailed as the best that we can manage from Earth-based telescopes. And I think you can see it's a magnificent-looking planet, even if you don't realize the scale. Well, let me give you the scale. Jupiter is not just the biggest planet, which probably most of you know that it is. Jupiter is so heavy that all by itself it weighs 2.5 times as much as all of the other planets, moons, asteroids, comets, and meteoroids put together. Most of the solar system is Jupiter. You're seeing 2/3 of the solar system right there. To give you an idea of the scale, the great red spot here is 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth. In other words, if the Earth were in this picture, it would look about like that. If Jupiter were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 planet Earths and still have room left over. Or to give you another idea of the scale, there on the cloud tops of Jupiter, and all this that you're seeing is clouds, there is no solid surface, is the shadow of the moon Io, which is somewhat bigger than our own moon, and so from one edge to the other, that little black dot is the distance across the United States, 2,500 miles. But in addition to being enormously bigger than a planet like the Earth, Jupiter is also fundamentally different. It is not made of rock. In fact, it has no solid surface. It is made entirely of gases and liquids. And the division between them is simply a matter of, you've got this enormous ball of primarily hydrogen and helium, and after that, water, methane, and ammonia, all of which outweigh the solid part of the planet. This ball is so huge, it's got so much gravity, it weighs 318 times as much as the Earth, that the pressure of this enormous amount of material being squeezed together by its own gravity simply compresses the gaseous material into something that you might as well call a liquid at a certain depth into the planet. It is not a well-defined depth. Almost certainly there is not a well-defined surface where the gas ends and the liquid begins the way there would be on Earth if you went from the atmosphere into the oceans. So let me simply use the word fluid so as to avoid semantic questions as to whether it's a gas or a liquid. There probably is rocky material in Jupiter. It may or may not have settled down to form a core. Even if it has, the core is going to be liquid for reasons that I'll tell you shortly. And if there is rocky material in Jupiter, it probably is a very tiny portion of the planet itself. I doubt that it weighs more than 5 times as much as the Earth, a mere nothing. Because Jupiter, after all, weighs 318 times as much. The thing that you have to understand, the most important thing that you have to understand Jupiter, is that there are two totally different kinds of bodies in the solar system which are called planets, and which are so different from one another that it's really misleading to use the same word planet to refer to both of them. What I'm talking about is Jovian planets, and those are Jupiter itself, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, and the other kind, terrestrial planets, so named because the Earth is one of them, and those are the remainder of the 16 large bodies in the solar system, that is the 9 planets plus the large moons. The difference between them is this. The universe consists almost entirely of hydrogen and helium. 99% of the matter that the universe is made of is either hydrogen, which is 90%, or helium, which is 9%. There's a reason for that. When the universe first formed, the so-called Big Bang, which led to the universe, or at least the present version of it, if the universe really does oscillate back and forth, somewhere around 15 or 20 billion years ago, we don't know that number very well, the processes that formed the atoms of which the universe is made were apparently capable of creating only the two very simplest kinds. And those are hydrogen, which is the simplest kind of atom of all, and helium, which is number two. The first generation of stars, which formed out of the resulting gas clouds, must have been made entirely of hydrogen and helium. However, stars shine, they keep themselves hot, by converting one kind of atom into another, a process called thermonuclear fusion. In the case of the Sun, which is a typical star, it shines by changing hydrogen to helium, and all that's doing is slightly enriching the amount of helium in the universe. It isn't doing anything more. But the very heaviest stars, and I don't know if you ever thought of stars in terms of their weight, but in fact it's the most important thing about them, the very heaviest stars are capable of shining, well, after they run out of hydrogen, they are capable of shining further by converting the helium into still heavier substances, helium into carbon, and then the carbon into still heavier things, and so on up. And that is the origin of the remaining 1% contamination of elements heavier than hydrogen and helium, which exists in our present-day universe. Because it turns out, by a wonderful coincidence, a coincidence which is the only thing that allows us to exist, that it is these same heavy stars, which are fairly rare, that are capable of creating elements heavier than hydrogen and helium in the first place. It is those very stars which end their lives in a spectacular manner that most stars do not, and that, for example, the Sun never will, and that is they become supernovae. They blow themselves apart. So that these titanic explosions, the blowing apart of an entire star, perhaps in a typical case 10 times as heavy as the Sun, that process is so violent that it spews all these heavy elements out into space and mixes them with the clouds of gas and dust, the so-called nebulae, from which younger generations of stars are forming. And that process had gone on for many times by the time the solar system formed. That number we know quite well, and we know it was much more recent than the origin of the universe itself. It was 4.6 billion years ago. By that time, the level of contamination in the gas cloud which gave rise to the solar system, that is the Sun and the planets which revolve around it, the moons that revolve around them, had reached a level of 1%. To this day, the Sun, which took up most of the matter in that cloud, is 99% hydrogen and helium. But there is that 1% residuum of everything else. Well, as the gas cloud, which was destined to become the solar system, shrank under the influence of its own gravity and began to pull itself together towards the center, a process which lasted somewhat longer than a million years or so. It was a relatively short-lived process, as astronomical timescales go. Most of the matter ended up in the center, and that formed the Sun. I told you Jupiter is so big that if it were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Earths, but the Sun is so big that if it were hollow, you could drop in 1,000 Jupiters. And the Sun, in fact, takes up 99.5% of the 2 billion tons of matter that make up our solar system. So most of that matter went together into the Sun. However, in the cloud of debris surrounding the Sun, during and after the time of its formation, there were secondary places where smaller amounts of matter happened to be a little bit more condensed than elsewhere, and those two were pulling themselves together, each towards a mutual center, and those were what were going to become the planets. That matter that was becoming each planet was made mostly of hydrogen and helium. In the case of the very largest of these condensations, the larger it is, the heavier it is, and therefore the more gravity it is, their gravities were sufficient to hold the hydrogen and helium. And those gases, you know, are very light. The Earth's gravity is not sufficient to hold them. Everybody knows what happens if you fill a balloon with either one or let it go up in the air. And so the material that was trying to form the Earth was being lost into space even as it was being formed. only the 1% residuum was left over to form the Earth. As a matter of fact, not even that, as I'll tell you a little bit later on. But in the case of Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune, they were heavy enough that their gravities were strong enough to suck in everything around them, whether it was hydrogen, helium, or anything else. Therefore, those bodies to this day are made mostly of hydrogen and helium. And that is what a Jovian planet is. Sometimes popularizers of astronomy, in attempting to express this, have said that Jupiter is really more like a star than a planet. That is a very bad way of putting it, because there are at least as many differences between Jupiter and a star like the Sun as there are between a Jovian planet like Jupiter and a terrestrial planet like the Earth. What they're trying to say is that Jupiter is very different from the Earth, and that is a valid point, and it's a very important thing to say. But there are just three completely different kinds of bodies that make up the solar system: the Sun, which is a star, the Jovian planets, and then the terrestrial planets. The Jovian planets do have in common with the stars that both of them are made mostly of hydrogen and helium. Because you see, the star had an even heavier gravity than the Jovian planets, and so of course it was going to suck in all the hydrogen and helium around it as well. But there are a lot of important differences. A star is extremely hot gas throughout. It is capable of engaging in thermonuclear reactions and keeping itself hot and therefore growing, which Jupiter is not and never has been able to do. And it is very, very much larger and heavier than Jupiter is. I have seen people who made the statement that Jupiter is really a star, when confronted with these statements, try to wiggle out of it by saying, well, what we really mean is that if Jupiter were a little heavier, it would be a star. Yeah, that's true. If Jupiter were 60 times as heavy as it is, it would have been a star. If I were 60 times as heavy as I am, I would have been an elephant. I looked up the numbers, that's the correct figure. And I don't see that that means that I'm almost as heavy as an elephant. You know, they're very different beasts, and Jupiter and the Sun are very different beasts. Well, the terrestrial planets did not have as much gravity. The Earth is a mere puny 6 sextillion tons of material that was so small that its gravity is not enough to hold the hydrogen and helium. And so, as I said, those matters escaped into space even as the Earth was trying to form. In fact, anything which was a gas at the Earth's location in the cloud of gas and dust that was forming the solar system, which is called the solar nebula, at the time that the Earth was forming, anything which was a gas at that time and place was lost into space. The Earth's gravity was not enough to hold them. And so a terrestrial planet differs from a Jovian planet in being made not of the normal matter that most of the universe is made of, which is to say hydrogen, helium, plus a 1% residuum of other things. A terrestrial planet is made only of those substances which happen to be solid at the particular place where the terrestrial planet was forming. And those are the materials, excuse me, at least those are included in the materials which the supernovae had created and spewed into space in the billions of years before the solar system was formed. That is what you and I and the Earth are made of, and if it were not for supernovae, you would not exist. You are quite literally made of stardust. That is the dust that the solar nebula was made from. Well, there's a further complication to this, a further interesting development of this picture, and that is that as you go out through the terrestrial planets, from the Sun outwards, you find there is a progressive change in what they are made of. And the reason for that is that in the outer part of the solar nebula, where it was far from the Sun and therefore colder, certain substances were able to be solid than in the inner part of the solar nebula, where it was a good deal hotter, and therefore those substances were gases. And it so happens that that matters. Because after the hydrogen and helium, which make up the majority of the matter in the universe, the remaining 1% is still arranged in a very undemocratic set of relative abundances. Oxygen is the third most abundant, and oxygen is almost as abundant as all the rest of it put together. After oxygen, the next commonest atom is neon, then comes carbon, and then comes nitrogen. All of those substances, except neon, that is to say oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, are capable of combining chemically with hydrogen. And of course, there was an enormous amount of hydrogen around, and so they did combine chemically with hydrogen, and in the solar nebula, those three atoms would have been present in, respectively, the forms of water, which is the compound of oxygen and hydrogen, mostly not liquid, of course, mostly either a gas or a solid, but water nonetheless, methane, which is the simplest compound of carbon and hydrogen, and ammonia, which is the compound of nitrogen and hydrogen. So if you were far enough out in the solar nebula that, for example, water was capable of being solid, a terrestrial planet formed out there would have been made more of water than of rock. Because the substances that rock is made of, which are primarily some of the oxygen, but then combined with silicon, which is less abundant than any of those other atoms that I've named so far, those are outweighed in the cosmos as a whole, and therefore in the solar nebula, by a factor of about 3 by the substances that water is made of, namely hydrogen and oxygen. The reason that the Earth is not made primarily of water is that in here, the solar nebula was so hot that water was a gas, and the Earth's gravity simply was not able to hold it. Well, it was not able to hold most of it. Obviously, we have a little bit of water, but equally obviously, even though 3/4 of the surface of the Earth is covered by the stuff, the volume of the Earth is almost entirely rock, and the weight of that water is negligible compared to the weight of the rock that makes up the Earth. Let's go through the solar system and find out what things are made of. The innermost planet, Mercury, was photographed by Mariner 10, and everybody who sees those pictures close up invariably has the same reaction right off, that is, it looks just like the moon, by which they mean, gee whiz, it's covered with craters. You know, I mean, there are a lot of bodies in the solar system that people say look just like the moon by that criterion. However, that is misleading, because the inside of Mercury is radically different from the moon. Most of the interior of Mercury, 80% of the volume of the planet, is an enormous iron-nickel core, like the one in the middle of the Earth, but that takes up only a third of the weight of our planet. In the case of Mercury, it is mostly iron and nickel. Mercury is basically a 3,000-mile ball bearing with a thin layer of rock on the outside, only a few hundred miles deep, which is what those craters formed in, and which is what gives you that superficial moon-like appearance. The reason for it is quite awe-inspiring. It is very simply that the Sun, at the time the planets formed, was hotter than it is now. Apparently, it was going through a brief stage, by which I mean it lasts about 100 million years, and that's brief compared to the 10 billion years the Sun was going to last afterwards, about halfway through that now. It was going through a brief stage, which a star goes through as it forms, in which the star is briefly several hundred to several thousand times brighter than it is going to be when it settles down and becomes a normal, stable, what we call a main sequence star, such as the Sun is today. That phase is called the T Tauri stage of stellar evolution, after a star which seems to be in the process of doing it right now. The star T Tauri is in the final stages of being born at this very moment. The Sun in its T Tauri stage was apparently so hot that at the distance of Mercury, 36 million miles from the Sun, rock was a gas. And only iron and nickel were capable of forming solids. And so most of Mercury is made of this huge iron-nickel core, and only toward the end of the million-year or so period during which Mercury accreted was the temperature cool enough, because the T Tauri stage was finally ending, that a thin shell of rock was able to solidify onto the outside. Go twice as far out, you get to Venus, 72 million miles from the Sun. That is made mostly of rock, so the temperature there evidently was not enough to vaporize the rocky matter. But Venus, as you learned last time, if you were here, is essentially without water. It has even less of the stuff than the Earth does. Earth, you know about, but what I want to emphasize is that it is made mostly of rock, and even on Earth, there is still very little water. Mars, the next one out, is still made mostly of rock. However, there is reason to believe that there is more water per cubic mile of Mars than there is per cubic mile of the Earth. Of course, it's not present in a liquid on that planet. A lot of it is still trapped inside the planet, undoubtedly, and such of it as has made its way to the surface has mostly frozen and is now under the ground in the soil as permafrost. And those of you who attended last year my Viking geology lecture here will remember the evidence that I showed that much of Mars, 80% of the surface, is underlain by permafrost, like the Arctic and Antarctic regions of the Earth. To go to the next terrestrial planets, you have to go 3 times farther out from the Sun. And there I'm not talking about Jupiter itself, of course. That's a Jovian planet. That's made of hydrogen and helium, because its gravity was enough to suck in everything, whether it was a solid or a gas. No, I'm talking about the 4 big moons, Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto, which revolve around Jupiter. Probably the weight of that enormous amount of overlying material would be enough to force it into a liquid form, but there is no way that it would be a solid. Jupiter is hot on the inside. In fact, Jupiter emits 2.5 times as much heat as it receives from the distant sun 500 million miles away. That fact was not discovered by the spacecraft, although it was confirmed by them and we got a better measurement. That fact had been discovered from Earth by radioastronomical observations because the hotter a planet is, the more natural radiostatic it emits, and we can measure its temperature quite accurately from 500 million miles away with a radio telescope. The question was, what it is that is producing this heat? And the answer is very simple. The answer is very simple and very straightforward and very awe-inspiring. Jupiter was enormously hot when it first formed, and in 4.5 billion years, it still has not had time to cool off completely. And so still, to this very day, this enormous amount of material is holding in enough heat that its central temperature is 6 times as hot as the surface of the sun. What that means is that everything about Jupiter is utterly alien compared to what we're used to on the Earth. For example, it is the heat is coming from inside the planet, not from the sun. What is that going to do to the meteorology? It is no cooler at night than it is in the daytime. It is no cooler in the poles than it is at the equator. As a matter of fact, it's hotter at the poles because, notice that Jupiter is flat. You see that? It's thicker by almost entire Earth diameter through the equator than it is through the poles. And as a result, the poles are closer to the heat source, which is the inside of the planet. Utterly alien. The reason that Jupiter is so flattened is partly because it is a liquid, and partly the simple and also awe-inspiring fact that this enormous body, the largest planet in the solar system, is also the one with the shortest day. This whole enormous mass of hydrogen and helium and other substances whirls around its axis once in less than every 10 hours, 9 hours 56 minutes to be exact, which means that a point on the equator of Jupiter is moving simply by virtue of the planet's rotation almost as fast as an Apollo spacecraft leaving the Earth to go to the moon. 22,000 miles an hour. The Apollo spacecraft is 25,000. A point on the equator of the Earth, by comparison, is moving at 1,000 miles an hour due to the Earth's rotation. So Jupiter is very flattened by the complex of phenomena which is invariant with this called centrifugal force. It is neither centrifugal nor a force, but you know what I mean. And as a result of that, if you look at it through a telescope, you can easily see that it looks as though it's been squashed at the poles. Whereas Earth's equatorial ball, which although it does exist, is only 1/3 of 1% of the diameter of the planet, and it's utterly unobservable if you look at a picture of Earth from space. The Earth is, in fact, more nearly spherical than the average billiard ball, some astronomer actually went to the trouble of checking that, and it is a very good analogy because a bowling ball has to be very nearly spherical or it will not do what it's supposed to do. I'll show you some more pictures. This is not a photograph, but a heat map of Jupiter. On Pioneer 10, there were not, and 11, which was essentially identical to it except for an extra magnetometer, there were not only cameras, there were a bunch of other instruments as well, 10 of them all together. And one of those was a device which measured the amount of heat that was being emitted by Jupiter itself by observing it in the far infrared. This is a set of observations of that sort, which have been converted to visual data so that the hotter, the brighter. And if you compare this with a visual photograph of Jupiter, you will find that everywhere this is bright, the cloud stripes are dark, and vice versa. In other words, the dark clouds are a region that is hotter than the bright clouds by about 15 degrees Fahrenheit. And the reason for that is simply, this is the proof of what I told you before, that the dark clouds are lower down in Jupiter's atmosphere and therefore closer to its center. Here is an indication of why that striped appearance occurs. In order to explain it to you, I have to tell you about the Coriolis effect, which is like centrifugal force, often incorrectly miscalled a force, and it is not. Coriolis, which in fact I alluded to without calling it by name in the Venus lecture as well, is something that is very important to a planet's meteorology. And what it means is that if you move north or south, you tend to veer in a direction that is not straight north or straight south. The reason is very simple. Let's suppose that I am standing on the equator, and you are standing in East Lansing, which is about halfway from the equator to the pole, and I throw you a ball, and we ignore your resistance and the fact that I'm not strong enough and all those little details for the interest of academics. I throw you a ball, and I throw it straight north, okay, because you're due north of me. You aren't going to catch it, because I throw that ball, and I not only impart you with some velocity due north, that ball, when it leaves my hand, is also traveling due east at 1,000 miles an hour as a result of rotation of the Earth. But as the ball travels north, the land under it, for example, the place where you are to try to catch it, is traveling at a smaller and smaller speed to the east because you're getting closer and closer to the rotational axis, and so, of course, you don't have to go as fast in order to go around in 24 hours. By the time it reaches East Lansing, in fact, the ground under the ball traveling at 700 miles an hour to the east. But the ball is still traveling at 1,000 miles an hour to the east, which means that from your point of view, as you stand there on the ground, which of course you foolishly think of as being stationary, from your point of view, the ball seems to be veering eastward away from you at 300 miles an hour. Okay? That's called the Coriolis effect. If you threw it to me southward, then it would be just the opposite effect. By the time, as it reached, as it left you, it would be traveling eastward at 700 miles an hour. By the time it reached me, it would be passing over land which was going at 1,000 miles an hour, and so it would seem to me as though the ball had fallen behind, as though it had veered to the west. That's called the Coriolis effect. It is what is responsible for the circulation in hurricanes and in ordinary high and low pressure centers, and you saw that in a very simple way in the pictures of Venus, where you had a circulation which would have been straight north and south in the two hemispheres away from the equator, except that, as I put it last time, the planet's rotation twisted into a spiral. Well, what twisted into a spiral is the Coriolis effect. On Jupiter, you've got such an enormous Coriolis effect that something goes even slightly north or slightly south, and it's just twisted around so it's essentially going due east or due west. And that is the reason for that striped appearance. What those cloud stripes are nothing more nor less than what on any less rapidly rotating, less enormous planet would be high and low pressure systems like those that we have on the Earth. But on Jupiter, they are distorted out to the point where they wrap completely around the planet. The circulation goes like this. Belt and zone refer respectively to a dark stripe and a bright stripe, and I never can remember which is which, and so, well, I mean, I do, I just did, but I always had a lot of trouble, so I don't expect you to either. I'll refer to them as dark and bright. The zones, the bright areas, are places where air is rising up from inside the planet because it's a little bit warmer. This is a process called convection. Any place where you have air that's a little bit warmer rises, any place where you have air that's a little bit cooler sinks. And you can get a nice circulation going that way, so you have continuous loops. As the air rises up, it does the same thing as rising air does on Earth. That is, if it has a material in it which is condensable, which is capable of turning from gaseous into solid or liquid, that material, when it becomes cold enough, as the air rises, does condense, and it forms a cloud. You can see convective clouds any warm summer afternoon. Remember warm summer afternoons? Any warm summer afternoon over the fields, you know, they're those little cottony, puffy cumulus clouds. And on Jupiter, the same sort of thing happens. The air rises up, the ammonia freezes out and forms those bright clouds, and then the air falls over and falls back down. But in doing so, it has to move away from the equator. And as soon as it moves away from the equator, Coriolis simply grabs it and jerks it. So it's moving almost due east. And you have winds at the edges between the bright and dark stripes, between the belts and the zones, as that air is being moved in one direction or the other. You have winds of 200 to 300 miles an hour. Those are the calm winds on Jupiter. I have not yet talked about Jovian storms. These are the equivalents of simple high-pressure areas on the Earth, our fair-weather region, with low-pressure areas in between them. I will talk about storms. Here's a picture which confirms some of what I was saying. Pioneer 11 flew over the poles of Jupiter, and therefore not directly over them, but what they were getting the pictures of them in high-latitude regions. And so you see that beautiful stretch appearance down here near the equatorial region, but then look what happens as you go towards the pole. There's the North Pole right at the top of the picture, and you can see that first of all, the perfect stripes begin to become more and more ragged, more and more imperfect. Individual cells appear, places where the wind happens to be unusually strong, and so they're able to maintain their identity a little bit better. Those are the equivalents of the high and low pressure centers that we have on the Earth. And finally, above about latitude 45 degrees north, the same thing happens down the south, as other pictures show, the banded structure breaks down entirely, and what you have then is just individual cells by the thousands. enormous ones. That one is about the size of North America. There's one a little bit smaller, maybe about the size of Europe, and it's not at all hard to find one. That one's almost the size of the Earth over there. It's not at all hard to find one that is, in fact, the size of the Earth. So Jupiter's weather is carried on at a scale that is appropriate for the king of the gods. One of the things that we're hoping to find out, now that we have these magnificent folded pictures and pictures that show a large part of the disk like that, from Pliny was 10 and 11, is what it looks like in detail when you get down inside those cells and to see whether there's a substructure within them. And that's the kind of thing that this exceedingly high-resolution camera capability of the Voyagers is going to do for us. There is one of the closest pictures that were taken by Pioneers 10 and 11, and this is the Great Red Spot with a couple of other storms near it. There's one, and there's one, and there's one. We do not know what it is that makes the Great Red Spot red. Carl Sagan likes to say the Great Red Spot is so named because it is orange. It's not a pure red, it's a sort of orange, a brownish red, but you can see that it is. There is some reason to believe that it may be phosphorus condensing out as the rising currents of air get cooler, and there's also some reason to believe that it may be compressed organic substances, not necessarily generated by life, although it is by no means impossible to rule out the possibility of life in Jupiter. Notice I say in, not on, okay? You even have to use different prepositions for these planets. The life on Earth is mostly swimming around in fluids, and it turns out that when you go down to the Jovian atmosphere and get into depths which would be appropriate for something to be swimming around in, the temperature is more or less reasonable for life as well. And Jupiter certainly has enormous amounts of energy to do chemical combinations and to feed the life after it's originated, and it has large amounts of water, methane, and ammonia, the three simplest substances from which life is believed to have originated here on the Earth somewhere around 3 billion years ago. What we do not know about Jupiter is whether there could be life that could somehow withstand this enormous turbulence, both vertical and horizontal, that goes on in the atmosphere. The Great Red Spot is an excellent example of the horizontal version of that. You can see in this picture that there is a cyclonic motion within the Great Red Spot. The Red Spot is nothing more nor less than a single enormous hurricane, a superstorm 2.5 times the diameter of the Earth, with winds of 500 miles an hour, which has been raging in Jupiter's atmosphere for at least 3 centuries now. We have had telescopes for only that long. We've been able to see it for that long. For all we know, it's been going there for millions of years, and it shows no sign whatsoever of letting up. Theoretical calculations show that, in fact, if a storm manages to get to that size, it has so much energy within itself that it's almost impossible to dissipate that energy as long as you are in a fluid environment. And in fact, even on Earth, hurricanes, as you probably know, maintain their existence as long as they're over the ocean and begin to dissipate only when they get over land. That's a little bit of a false analogy because part of the reason for that is they're picking up energy from the water itself, from the oceans, as they go through phase changes, but it is suggestive and it is partially valid. The Great Red Spot, as we found from the temperature measurements, is the highest place in Jupiter's atmosphere. Those clouds are 5 miles above the level of what is surrounding them. And basically what you've got here is one of the very strongest storms in Jupiter, something which, if it were weaker, would have been twisted out by Coriolis until it went completely around the planet. Only the very strongest storms are able to maintain their individuality and not get smeared out into a complete band. And you can see, in fact, that even the Great Red Spot has been severely elongated, and the same is true of these other storms, both bright and dark clouds around it. Most of those taller storms do not last very long. There are some that have been known to last as long as decades. Most of them last only a few months or fewer years. Here's another picture of a storm on Jupiter of probably a different type. Something has erupted from underneath the clouds and smeared itself out as the Coriolis began to affect it. You can see that it was okay as long as it stayed where it was, but as soon as it tried to move a little bit south, right away, wham, around it goes. You see that? That little hook-shaped configuration as a result, and it has smeared itself out into a structure which is, in length, about 5 times as long as the diameter of the Earth. You also see some very nice smaller storms down there. There's one that's about the size of the Earth. There's one that's maybe 3/4 that size. There's a little baby which is only about the size of North America and so forth. This is one of the closest pictures that was made by Pioneer 11. 11 because it got closer to the planet than 10. And it gives you, you already know everything what to look for in it, but I simply wanted to give you an idea of how much detail there is in these features. Magnificent planet. It's just, it must be really awe-inspiring to stand there and look at it, as someday we may be able to do, but not someday soon. I haven't told you about the radiation environment around there yet. Question?
Grossly enhanced contrast, and what would it look like
this if we were on Io? Question is, do they increase the contrast of this picture as they do for Mars pictures and as they do for Venus pictures as well? The answer is no. That is very much the way it would look to the naked eye. This is a picture of the inside of Jupiter according to the Pioneer 10 and 11 data. Pioneers 10 and 11, of course, did not land, did not go down to Jupiter, let alone try to go into the inside, but by measuring what Jupiter's gravity did to them as they went around, we can get a good notion of the distribution of matter of different densities and therefore different substances within the planet. What you've got is, it says atmosphere, of course that's a sort of silly term, the whole planet is atmosphere if you want to call it that, but atmosphere that is a gaseous substance. It says cloud tops 240 kilometers or 150 miles down. I have not been able to figure out what they mean down from. There's some reference level that somebody has established in Jupiter's atmosphere and that the person who made this drawing was using, but ordinarily we measure height in Jupiter from above and below the cloud tops. Somewhere around 600 miles down, that is to say 450 miles below the cloud tops, there is a gradual transition from what you might call gas to what you might call liquid. At the time that Pioneer 10 and 11 made these observations, news reports tended to say that Jupiter was made mostly of liquid hydrogen. And that is correct, but it's misleading. It is hydrogen and it is a liquid. But to you and me, I think, when we hear the phrase liquid hydrogen, we think of a substance of more or less ordinary pressure, which has been liquefied because it has been cooled to 450 below zero and Fahrenheit, and therefore is liquefied for that reason. This is a matter that is enormously hot, thousands of degrees. And the reason that it is liquid is simply that that savage pressure has crushed what otherwise would be quite a hot gas into a state where the atoms are so close together you call it a liquid. Below about 15,000 miles, it is predicted theoretically that, and to some extent confirmed observationally by the pioneers, that there is a transition to a material which lasts to almost the remainder of the planet. It says here small rocky core, maybe there is, as I told you. And that is a substance which has never been created in the laboratory because we cannot generate pressures that are that high, even instantaneously. However, it has been theoretically calculated. We think it exists. Liquid metallic hydrogen. A substance which is a metal, which is to say its electrons have been squeezed off it and are forming an independent, interpenetrating substance of their own which forces its way in between what is left of the atoms, the nuclei, and yet it is a liquid. It starts 15,000 miles down where the temperature is already 20,000 degrees Fahrenheit and the pressure is 3 million times the 14.7 pounds per square inch that we have at the surface of the Earth. Liquid metallic hydrogen is a metal and therefore is capable of transmitting electricity. It is also capable of transmitting heat very well, and that is one thing which keeps the interior temperature of Jupiter as high as it is. And the fact that you don't have the liquid metallic hydrogen all the way out is one thing that helps keep that heat inside the atmosphere. Although the atmosphere itself, even the gaseous part, is very good at holding in heat. For those of you who were here last time, what I mean is it has a very high greenhouse effect. Hydrogen has a ferocious greenhouse effect. That, in fact, is why Titan, the big moon of Saturn, even though it's a billion miles from the sun, could possibly be warm enough to sustain life. We think that it may have an atmosphere that is made mostly of hydrogen. We don't know that. If it does, then it may have a very, very high greenhouse effect, be able to trap what tiny bit of solar heat reaches that far out. The liquid metallic hydrogen is probably the reason for Jupiter's magnetic field. It has one. It has a very strong one, five times as strong as that of the Earth. And a magnetic field in a planet is generated by motions of electrically charged fragments of atoms which are moving around in some sort of convective circulation. The nature of that circulation is not understood very well. We don't know what would be driving it, but the origin of Jupiter's magnetic field is probably that. As a matter of fact, Pioneer 11, which got closer to Jupiter than Pioneer 10 did, measured that it does not have one single magnetic field, in the sense that there is a single north magnetic pole and a single south magnetic pole. There are a number of them in different places in the planet. And what you measure as you go by is a complex combination of magnetic fields, and that may be due to individual circulation patterns within the liquid metallic hydrogen. Question here. If you have questions, by the way, and I don't see you raise your hand, don't just sit there and suffer and yell question or hey you or yo funny looking or something, and I'll be happy to call on you. Less happy as that sequence goes through. Yes?
Yeah, the cloud tops, the outermost level of the atmosphere, is there atmosphere above the cloud?
Are the cloud tops the outermost level of the atmosphere, or is there gas above them? The answer is the latter, and the gas simply, excuse me, gets less and less dense. Very rapidly, of course, since the gravity is so great, as you go into space. As with Earth's atmosphere, there is no edge to Jupiter's atmosphere. It just peters out in interplanetary space. So that reference level that is being used there, that the cloud tops are 150 miles below, is somebody's notion of where the atmosphere, for practical purposes, has ended. But exactly how they define that, I don't know, because it depends on what you mean by practical purposes. You know, you can orbit satellites at heights in the Earth's atmosphere where they will last for decades, and yet there are aurorae happening in those heights, and the satellites are used to study the atmosphere at those heights, you know. So it just depends on your definition. Let's look at the atmosphere itself briefly. There, according to theoretical calculations, there should be at least three layers of clouds. The ammonia are the ones, frozen ammonia are the ones at the top, and there are the ammonium hydrosulfide clouds, and below that, the artist seems to have forgotten to put a layer, but below that there should be, in fact, cirrus clouds, clouds made of frozen crystals of water, the same as the very highest clouds of the Earth are, which are at heights about 5 miles up, where the temperature is so cool that in the Earth's atmosphere, liquid water cannot exist. This is the temperature curve in degrees Fahrenheit, and you can see that already at the height of the water crystal clouds, the temperature is approaching, just under them, the temperature is approaching 100 degrees. Obviously, it's got to be 32 or less for water crystal, and it falls to a minimum at which defines the boundary between the troposphere and the layer above, which is called the stratosphere, a minimum of about 250 below zero. At the ammonia clouds, it averages somewhere around minus 200, minus 150. Jupiter's magnetic field has some very dramatic effects of its own. You may be aware of the so-called Van Allen radiation belts, which are found in the magnetosphere, the very badly named, totally non-spherical region within which the Earth's magnetic field is confined. Jupiter has a magnetosphere as well, and we have known for a long time, long before the spacecraft got there, that Jupiter did indeed have a set of Van Allen radiation belts similar to ours, but possibly stronger. No one knew how much stronger they might be. The reason we were able to tell this is the so-called radiation belts. Radiation is one of those words that scientists use in several ways, and it's ambiguous, and you can get very confused about it. What they mean in this particular case is particles of atoms, fragments of atoms, mostly protons and electrons. In other words, hydrogen atoms, which make up the majority of Jupiter's atmosphere, that may or may not be where they're coming from. There's reason to believe that in this case they are. In the case of the Earth's Van Allen belts, most of them are not from the atmosphere. Hydrogen atoms, which have been torn apart into protons and electrons, and the protons and electrons are forced to stay within the region of the planet's magnetic field by that magnetic field itself. They orbit around the lines of force of the magnetic field, but they cannot get out, being electrically charged. If the object is electrically charged, it is forced, it is constrained to stay within the magnetosphere of the planet. Well, the electrons, as they orbit around the magnetic field lines, give off radio emission. Jupiter, I already mentioned, gives off radio emission by virtue of the fact that it's hot, and that radio emission is up around the millimeter region of the radio spectrum. But Jupiter also gives off two other kinds of radio emission. What we are talking about here is in the decimetric range, that is to say, wavelengths of the order of a decimeter, which is about 4 inches, in other words, 10 centimeters. And in addition to that, Jupiter gives off enormously powerful bursts of radiostatic in the decametric range, which is to say wavelengths of tens of meters, and that is just below the standard AM broadcast band. The decimetric radiation is not coming from Jupiter itself, as radioastronomical observations rather quickly showed, but rather from a donut-shaped region around Jupiter, and it seemed quite obvious that that was coming from electrons, and that was how we knew there was a radiation belt. But if you're flying through the radiation belt, what does the damage to you is not particularly the electrons, which are very lightweight little things, it is the protons. Those are a great deal heavier, 1,875 times heavier to be exact. Furthermore, they are, since they are so very much heavier, capable of penetrating a good deal further, doing a great deal more damage. But since they are so very much heavier, they do not give off as much radio emission. And so you cannot tell that they're there. And we knew that Jupiter's environment was complicated enough that we couldn't just go assuming for every electron there's a proton because every hydrogen atom had one of each. We simply did not know how intense those radiation belts were. They were worried about it. There were fears that when Pioneer 10 went out there and made history's first approach of a spacecraft to Jupiter, that the radiation would literally destroy it. That the sleet of subatomic particles passing through the spacecraft would destroy the delicate electronic components, and not destroy in the sense of tearing it apart. From the outside, you wouldn't notice any change whatever, but its interior, its electronic capability would be destroyed. And there was a lot of argument about how close the spacecraft should go to Jupiter. Finally, more or less as a compromise, an approach distance of 81,000 miles was selected. Jupiter's diameter is 86,000 miles, so what we were talking about was that it went just short of one Jupiter diameter above the cloud tops. And there was a lot of worry about that. There was fear that even that was far too close, and there was a real serious danger that Pioneer 10 might have been destroyed by that close an approach. Well, it turned out that both pessimistic calculations as to how strong the radiation belt might be were in error. It was stronger. No one had predicted that the radiation belt could be as intense as it turned out to be. Depending on the energy class of particles that you're talking about, it is as much as a million times as strong as the radiation belts of the Earth. Which means that since all four of the moons revolve around Jupiter within the radiation belt, and the inner three, Io, Europa, and Ganymede, revolve within the innermost part of it, that a human being on any of those inner three would be killed by the radiation within a couple of hours, and even on Callisto, a human being would be killed within a few weeks. So you can forget for a long time about those science fiction stories about colonies on the moons of Jupiter. It was a nice idea back when we didn't know anything about the environment those moons are in, but it's a very different situation in reality. In fact, the radiation belts would probably be several thousand times stronger than they are if the moons were not in there. Because remember, the so-called radiation is actually matter. It is atoms or fragments thereof. And the moons, as they go moving through the radiation belt, carve tunnels through the radiation belt material at the expense, of course, of having all of this stuff fall down onto their own surfaces and become embedded. If it were not for this sacrificial property of the moons themselves, then the radiation belts would be even more intense than they are. And that's the reason that I said that Io is covered with radioactive salt. I haven't explained the red yet, and I haven't explained the salt yet, but now you know why it is radioactive. Pioneer 10 took in a total radiation dose 1,000 times the amount necessary to kill an unprotected human being. And it was estimated later that it had performed better than it was supposed to. Actually, according to the specifications the engineers had given, and they always try to build better than those specifications, the specifications are pessimistic numbers, if it had performed as the specifications, it would in fact have been destroyed. Fortunately, it did better than that, but it was estimated later that if that spacecraft had gone just a few percent closer to Jupiter, it would in fact have been destroyed by the radiation. So the engineers who picked that 81,000 mile distance can be very proud of themselves for what they did. As it was, there was one instrument on Pioneer 10, fortunately one that was not needed thereafter, that was destroyed by the radiation, and they also had a problem that had been foreseen, and that was that these particles fleeting through the spacecraft are, after all, an electric current, right? They're electrically charged and they're moving, so they constitute an electric current. The computer on the Pioneer Jupiter spacecraft was a relatively dumb computer. Much dumber than the one on the Viking landers, which in turn is dumber than the ones on the Voyagers. Those have very smart computers. So smart, in fact, they gave us a lot of trouble at the White House. They started thinking for themselves just after the launch of the first spacecraft, and they weren't supposed to, but we got a discipline now, and the second spacecraft had no trouble. Well, the computer on Pioneer 10 was quite dumb. In fact, almost all of the mission control had to be done from the ground, and that is very difficult because it takes the radio signals traveling from the Earth to Jupiter and back again 3/4 of an hour to make the round trip. So that if something goes wrong and the spacecraft screams for help, and it takes that much time for the signal to go back from the spacecraft to the Earth and for your corrective measures to go up to the spacecraft, 3/4 of an hour has gone by before anything could happen, anything that you could do about it would actually take effect. A lot of advanced thinking had to go into flying spacecraft with a computer that simple. What happened when they encountered the radiation belts was the computers, in some cases, interpreted these surges of current, which were passing through themselves as well as the rest of the spacecraft, as commands from Earth. And so they would do things like turn off the camera right around close approach. This had been foreseen. And every 10 minutes, for 48 hours before and 48 hours after the closest approach, a steady stream of commands was sent to the spacecraft every 10 minutes. Turn on your camera. Turn on your radiation detector. Turn on your infrared instrument. Turn on this. Turn on that. The spacecraft was so designed that if it got such a command and the instrument in question was already on, it would ignore it. But if the instrument were off, of course, it would turn it on. As a result of that, if these false signals were to turn off one of the instruments, at most, it would be off for only 10 minutes before it was turned back on again. And so we lost a very few of the pictures. Each of the spacecraft took about 300 pictures altogether. Compare that with about 200,000 for each Voyager-Jupiter encounter. We lost a few of those, including, unfortunately, one of the very closest of the red spot and a close one of Io. But for the most part, we got all the pictures that we should have. Now, the structure of the radiation belt also turned out to be quite a shock. The boundary of it, labeled here as magnetosphere boundary, is the boundary between the interplanetary magnetic field, which is carried by the solar wind, the very, very thin stream of gas, which is constantly moving away from the sun in all directions. It fills the entire inner solar system. It passes the Earth and Moon at a speed of about 300 miles an hour. Of course, the term wind is very misleading. You would not feel a wind on your face, if you were out there in it. But it is detectable, and it goes out at least as far as Jupiter, and the strange thing is it does so, it speeds up as it goes out. That's an example of the interplanetary space kinds of observations, which I mentioned that these pioneers make. Someday, we hope to find the edge of the solar wind. There must be an edge to it somewhere when the pressure of the solar wind, which of course gets weaker and weaker as it goes out, becomes equal to the pressure of the very, very thin gas in interstellar space, which is pushing inward against it. That place may be found by Pioneer 11. It is not likely to be found by Pioneer 10. The direction that the sun is moving through the interplanetary gas, of course, helps to determine what that pressure is in various directions. And what will happen is, as the sun is moving through the interstellar gas, as the sun is moving through the interstellar gas, the heliopause, the edge of the sun's domain, is going to be compressed in this direction and extended out into a long tail in the opposite direction. Pioneer 11 happens to be escaping the solar system almost in the direction that the sun is traveling at around the speed of 12 miles a second. Pioneer 10 happens to be going in almost the other direction along the tail. So 10 is not likely to hit the boundary, but 11 may, and it happens that both of the Voyagers will escape roughly the direction the sun is going, and they won't be able to transmit from very, very much greater distances than the Pioneers. So if we don't get it from the Pioneers, we should be able to get it from the Voyagers. There is reason to believe the Voyagers may be detectable as much as 30 years after launch, when they will be 100 astronomical units, an astronomical unit is the distance from the Earth to the sun, out away from us. Jupiter is 5 astronomical units away. Pluto is only 40 astronomical units away. So you see, we're talking about more than twice as far from the sun as Pluto itself is. And among other things, the Voyagers are therefore the first probes of interstellar space. If Pioneer 11 is not able to send back in one of its last dotting tests toward the end of its mission, the first observations itself. Well, we have the same kind of structure on a much interview with a laser guy named Trudy Milliner. on a program called Radio Free Detroit. I love that title, which is broadcast at 7:15 on Sunday morning. It'll be this coming Sunday. The station is 99 FM, and it will be for 1 hour on space colonization. Oh, and another announcement, too, about space colonization. For those of you who are interested in that subject, and we've been mentioning it periodically through this series, and we did have a lecture on it back in May with myself and Tom Heppenheimer, there is, we've talked about the L5 Society a number of times, and that's a citizens group which is interested in the concept and which you can join, and of which there is a chapter here at Michigan State, which I'll be happy to plug if there's anybody here from L5. I don't notice the two or three that I know. Okay, apparently there was some false information floating around. At least one of them is expecting to come next Thursday. He's going to be very unhappy when she discovers that it was a week ago. There is an L5 Society here on campus, but in addition, Gerard O'Neill, who was the originator of the concept in its modern form, has started a nonprofit institute for space studies. It's called the Institute for Space Studies, to do some of the badly needed footwork that still has to be done and still can be done on a relatively modest scale in this relatively early stage of the program. Obviously, the time will come when private institutes funded by public donations aren't enough. But if you would like to become a member of that, they put out a newsletter, so does the L5 Society. This will give you another look at it. And it's $10 a year. And the address, fascinating, the address I don't have here. All right. The address is Space Science Institute, care of Professor Gerard O'Neill, Princeton University Physics Department, Princeton, New Jersey. You know, that'll get to him, whatever the correct address is, they'll forward it. Okay, what we've got here tonight is a lecture about Jupiter, and that is the primary goodie, but we have something else for you especially, which was not advertised. It just happened I was able to get it at the last minute, and only lasts 4 minutes, and I thought you'd like to see it. It's a really superb film clip, which was put out originally for television use by the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston, and it is a clip of the first free flight of the approach and landing test of the Space Shuttle Orbiter. And without further ado, I'd like to put that on now. Do you have a slide on again? Thank you very much, and I'd like to thank Eva Payne of the Johnson Space Center for supplying that to us on very short notice. A few more announcements that I thought of while we were watching that. There are always a lot of them. Tomorrow night in Ann Arbor, I am giving the first of a series of three presentations, mostly a lecture, but also some films, on updates of the Viking Mars finding, things that have been learned in the last year or so, and that is material that I guarantee you aren't going to get anywhere else. Even the specialized news media have started in on that. The other two are next Friday and the Friday after, and all the information about those is here on this mimeograph sheet, including detailed driving directions on how to get there. The Voyager recording, as you heard on the way in, is being played. We played the first of the four segments, four half-hour segments, roughly, that we've chopped it up into today, and the remaining three, all of which are music, will be played before the beginning of each of the next three lectures. Those are a little bit earlier, those begin a little bit earlier than the segments that you heard today. Those begin at 7:05 p.m., and that information is on the yellow sheet, which gives the Michigan State schedule, and that's the one that is in the back of the room. The portion that you heard today is the entirety of the non-musical portion. We began, with a little bit of music, just a brief musical intro, which in fact is the same as the piece that ends the recording 2 hours later, and that is the Cavatina from Beethoven's 13th String Quartet. Then the greetings first from Secretary General Ballheim, from a number of ordinary citizens in 55 separate languages, starting with ancient Sumerian, which is the oldest that is still known in enough detail that you could still say something in it, and ending with modern English. Then a series of greetings from members of the Outer Space Committee of the United Nations, and fading slowly into a couple of whales who sent their own greetings as well. And then that very remarkable sound essay, which was put together primarily by Andrew in New York City, starting with relatively simple sounds, volcanoes, mud pots, fire, thunderstorm, working up through natural sounds of a low order of complexity, insects and frogs and so forth, high order of complexity, finally simple human sounds, and then culminating in the most complex, one of the most complex of human sounds, the launch of a Saturn V. And then as a brief coda, perhaps the only section whose content was not more or less immediately obvious to what was going on, there was little indication that life is still going on the Earth, is continuing, and is a part of the broader universe of which we are a part. A kiss, the cry of a baby, an electroencephalogram, and an electrocardiogram, as expresses audio analogs, and finally the very final sound, that hypnotic shh, 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 at the very end. That was a pulsar. So that's what that was about. The remainder of it is music, and in my opinion, one of the finest introductions you could possibly imagine to the musics of planet Earth. It was put together very carefully by ethnomusicologists and by other musical experts, and you can be sure that each of the pieces is a representative sample of its genre. It breaks down by time, 40% Western classical music, 10% American popular music, of which there are three different representations, and the remaining 50%, therefore, is music of types that you are not likely to have encountered before unless you are really into ethnomusicology. So I think it's a very interesting thing, quite aside from the fact that this is literally the most immortal music that the human race has ever produced. There is every reason to believe those recordings will last for billions of years into the future as the Voyager spacecraft carry them out into the, carry them out among the stars. That's the end of the Voyager mission. The beginning of it is what I will start to talk about tonight and continue next time, which is called Beyond Jupiter, tonight's lecture being Jupiter. These are explorations of the outer solar system. We have already had two spacecraft out there, Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11. The Voyagers are more complex, more sophisticated, they'll be able to do more. The idea is to send out a relatively simple, rugged, reliable spacecraft to brave the dangers of things like the asteroid belt and Jupiter's radiation belt. The former of which turned out to be much less dangerous than we thought it might be, the latter of which turned out to be a great deal more so. Once you have some notion of what the environment is like, then you can send in your more sophisticated, but therefore more fragile spacecraft, and that's what the Voyagers are about.